State Senate and open a work session on executive appointments and invite Todd Masham to come forward, and we will start by having you tell us why you desire to serve us in this capacity.
Thank you, Chair Starr, members of the committee. My name is Todd Basham. I'm the governor's appointee to the Land Use Board of Appeals, or LUBA. Over the last 2 years, I've had the pleasure and privilege of working as LUBA's staff attorney, assisting the board in resolving appeals of local land use decisions. As you may know, LUBA's review process is designed to resolve appeals of land use decisions as rapidly and as fairly as possible, so that land use applications and decisions remain as briefly as possible in legal limbo, while ensuring that land use decisions, either approvals or denial of development, are consistent with state and local requirements. That task requires LUBA to resolve over 250 appeals per year on an expedited schedule mandated by statute. My writing ability and experience has been instrumental in helping the board to meet that challenge. Last year, I drafted approximately 60% of LUBA's opinions that reached the merits. In my role as staff attorney, I have participated in most of the functions of a board member, conducting oral arguments, helping the board deliberate on decisions, and drafting and reviewing orders and final opinions. It is work that I am intimately familiar with and work that I greatly enjoy. A particular source of satisfaction to me is the progress LUBA has made recently in reducing its backlog of appeals. As you may know, since 1991, LUBA's workload has doubled from around 100 cases a year to 250 cases per year, which resulted eventually in a backlog of appeals that the board has kept from growing larger, but that until recently has resisted efforts to eliminate. One consequence of that backlog is that LUBA has been unable to comply consistently with its statutorily mandated schedule in far too many cases. However, last year, due to in part to increased LUBA productivity, LUBA reduced the size of the backlog by about 20%. This year, if current trends hold true, LUBA will eliminate that backlog entirely. Helping LUBA achieve that objective is both a personal and professional goal for me. My productivity as a staff attorney has played a role in that effort, ensuring LUBA's to compliance with the statutory mandate. I look forward to the opportunity as a board member to help LUBA achieve that objective. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Excellent. Senator Brown.
What did you learn with clerking for Judge Redding?
Gosh. That was a great experience clerking with Judge Redding. It was a real privilege to see things from a judicial perspective rather than as an advocate's perspective. And that's helped me a great deal in my work at LUBA, understanding and appreciating the needs of the parties and trying to resolve those as fairly as possible. I was greatly impressed with his integrity and the integrity he brought to the process, and I tried to learn and apply that myself.
Senator Mullick,
thank you. Let me ask, the length of this term is 4 years, correct?
Correct, Senator Mullick.
If we approve your appointment, would you expect that you would serve the entire 4 years?
Senator Miller, if I should. Miller, yes, I expect I will.
And further, since you're a bright legal scholar, if, and we don't forecast this certainly, but if you were resubmitted for an appointment, a reappointment in 2003, March thereof, and for whatever reason the Senate rejected that reappointment, would you expect to continue serving?
I'm sorry if I misunderstood the question.
If the Senate actually rejected your reappointment, would you think it would be appropriate for you to just continue on?
Chair Starr, Vice Chair Miller, I would not consider that to be appropriate.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Further questions? Anyone else want to testify on behalf of this appointment? Not. Well, we thank you very much. And so entertain.
Chairman, I would move that we recommend the approval and appointment of Todd Basham to the Land Use Board of Appeals.
Senator Miller has moved that we
do that.
Recommend approval of the governor's appointment of Todd Basham to the Land Use Board of Appeals. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Brown.
Aye.
Senator Miller.
Aye.
Senator Scott.
Aye. I received the necessary majority. The recommendation of approval has moved to the Senate floor. We have Carrie.
Mr. Chair, I'd actually like to carry. I'm related to Mr. Basham in a certain way. I work with his sister, Susan. At the Wirtz and Menasche, which was the first law firm I worked at. So we have a distant connection. So if I may, I'd like to carry it.
All right. Senator Brown will carry. With that, we close the work session on executive appointments. And thank you, Mr. Basham. And we will open hearing and possible work session. We're going to have a hearing on HJM 8 and representing winners. Do we have Devin?
Devin
Lyon from the Speaker's office.
Yes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jackie Winters, State Representative District 31. I'm losing my voice. I'll let Dave start off and then I'll wrap up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Devin Lyon, Speaker Snodgrass's office. I would actually, at what point do we start this? Can I just pretty much take it from it?
Okay.
I'm going to read from some prepared testimony. We had a couple questions that arose in the House committee, so we did a little bit more early, and I'd just rather read it. And then we'll open it up for questions. Okay, I'm here to introduce HJM 8 on behalf of the Speaker Snodgrass and Representative Winters. HJM 8 urges the President, Congress, to ensure that a fair and legal federal decennial census is conducted in 2000. HJM 8 opposes the use of data for state legislative redistricting based on census numbers that have been determined in whole or in part by the use of statistical inference derived by means of random sampling techniques or other statistical methodologies that add persons to or subtract persons from the census count. It is our belief that the statistical sampling raises questions of vote dilution and violates one person, one vote legal protections. Basing our redistricting on lines drawn using the statistical sampling could open the state of Oregon up to litigation. The data will most likely be challenged. I base this statement on my understanding that the opponents of the sampling method argue it violates the same one vote, one person legal principle the United States has used for over 200 years to conduct the census. HJM 8 demands the state of Oregon receive data for legislative redistricting identical to the census data used to apportion seats in the United States House of Representatives. I would now like to address some of the counter arguments that were brought up during debate in the House for HJM 8. Historically, there's been a high undercount that has occurred in urban areas throughout the United States. We do not disagree with this assertion, but we disagree with correcting the problem through statistical sampling. To underscore this, let me first give you an example of how the sampling method works, and it's a simple example. Let us say that in a suburban area surrounding one of the 11 designated problematic urban cities, there's a high number of Caucasian women between the ages of 40 to 50 that are married. That's the cohort, I guess. Remember that these people are real and that they've actually been counted by census employees. Based on a complex statistical formula, this group may be tagged as having been overrepresented and then they would be subtracted. Really, they'd be counted as 0.98% of a person. But when this is done over millions of people, obviously the amount becomes significant. Once tagged as overrepresented, they are subtracted. The numbers then re-added to the supposed underrepresented areas. This can be bad for a few different reasons. First, it takes real people who have been accurately counted by the Census Bureau and removes them. Secondly, it adds phantom individuals to these hard-to-reach or count urban and lower-income areas that have been considered underrepresented by the formula. Third, there is a distinct possibility that an inflated and inaccurate number of this predetermined underrepresented group will be added to the problematic areas. Replacing a broken system with a suspect formula is not the answer. Instead, HGM8 encourages Congress, the U.S. Census Bureau, and the President to hire extra census counters to target the 11 problematic urban cities, not just to hire more individuals, but to hire them from within the communities themselves, thus either eliminating or drastically reducing the problem that census counters have had in these areas. Historically, the undercount has been attributed to the census counters' inability to enter these urban and often poor inner cities and gather the information. Currently, there is a movement in Washington, D.C. to provide the necessary funding to see that not only the number of census counters has increased, but that there is concerted effort made to target and drastically reduce the undercount that occurred in these. Last, I would like to address two recent Supreme Court decisions, United States Supreme Court versus United States House of Representatives and Clinton, President of the United States, v. Glavin. Both of these ruled on January 25, 1999, that the Census Act prohibits the Census Bureau's proposed use of statistical sampling in calculating the population for purposes of congressional apportionment. And I want to make this clear, because there seemed to be a misunderstanding on the committee side, that this decision only speaks to congressional apportionment, not House redistricting. And we understand that and we agree with it. But HGM8 does urge Congress and the President to make the full enumeration data available to us, the state level, to for the purposes of redistricting. So on the behalf of the Speaker and Representative Winters, we urge passage as amended. We have a brief amendment. It's page 2, line 20. Replacing the word Oregon with the word United States of America was just a slight error in the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, this resolution really is about fairness and accuracy counting, and it's about something else. I thought long about this particular issue from a standpoint of history. Minorities and in general do not believe that we are ever accurately counted. And we also believe that with not being counted, that we don't exist. And to me it's very important that we send the message that we not be statistically counted, that every attempt is made that we are counted. When I spoke on the floor, I reminded my colleagues of the fact that my grandfather worked on the streets of Topeka to earn the right to vote through poll tax. And when I went home to check the record, census record for my dad, and I found that in Kansas that the Native American was summarily not even included in the census, and my dad was very upset that he wasn't a part of that census. My mother was listed as a mulatto. And so for us it's important. It speaks volumes. I told someone we had the acknowledgement day the other day, and we talked about prior history. I think that the message of inclusion is just as important for us, that we really do exist in the United States of America and that we are an American. And so that was my appeal to my fellow colleagues. And the other one, when the argument is made about those areas where it's difficult for census counters to go in because of whether it's fear or for whatever reason, that we could also provide some employment for those individuals who were there and who are not afraid to count their neighbors, and to go into the homeless area. So I would just urge you to pass this out and vote yes.
I actually have several questions, and you talked about targeting 11 cities. I didn't read any specific target in the memorial in terms of 11 cities.
The way I understand it is that the Census Bureau has determined in a report to Congress that the undercount occurred significantly in 11 cities that they've deemed problematic. That's where they would like to target extra census counters if they go that direction. That's where the highest amount undercount occurred.
But the memorial isn't targeted to those 11 cities. It's targeted the state of Oregon, correct?
Senator Brown, if I may, on page 2 of the memorial, there's a proposed amendment that would, on line 20, that would change Oregon to the United States.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chair, I have several other questions, if I may.
Yes.
Representative Winters, you talked about making sure people stand up and be counted. It's my understanding that in 1991, Congress did initiate a study that showed that the only way to reduce the undercount at reasonable cost was through statistical sampling, and that study was conducted by the National Academy of Sciences as a result of the Census Improvement Act. Are you saying we should ignore the results of Congress's own study, and it's worth spending, you know, whatever $1 billion more to do the additional counting?
You know, Senator Brown, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I really do. I think the issue, and we've all dealt with this issue of race relations, and we've talked a lot about it here as well as in Washington. And you know as well as I do that perception is real. And when you have a society of individuals who do not believe that they're a part of, and counting, census counting is a mechanism that says you exist. So if it does take that, I really do believe that we need to send that message that, yes, we are going to try to count everyone.
And would you agree with me that minorities have been overrepresented in the undercount? That the undercount disproportionately affects minorities and low-income people?
That we're more apt to be undercounted? And that was the argument last time the census was taken as well.
Sure.
Other question.
And I guess this would be for you in terms of the language. On page 2, lines 7 and 8, it says the use of adjusted census data would raise serious questions of vote dilution and violate one vote legal protections, citing the case. And I guess when I reviewed the case, I saw that was a finding of fact, but I didn't see that that was a concern in terms of the dilutions of vote. To prohibit statistical sampling. I guess I'm concerned that the resolution doesn't accurately state what the Supreme Court found, lines 2 and 3 and then 7 and 8.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, unfortunately I'm just not a lawyer and I'm not really able to speak to that appropriately.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, may I address Senator Brown? Senator Brown, one thing, from how I understand it, both are going to be done because of the Supreme Court ruling. The full enumeration simply has to be used to apportion congressional seats. The statistical sampling method is also going to be done. So both sets of data are going to be available. From how I understand it, as an aside note for matters of fairness, I think it was explained to me that a lot of it has to do with the possible litigation. I guess there are some national bodies that think if you redraw your seats this way, you're going to be bringing on...
I agree with you on a apportionment level in terms of how many congressional seats you'll get in a state. But so it would certainly affect your individual congressional districts. But would you agree with me that it really has nothing to do with drawing legislative districts?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, of course the Supreme Court decision absolutely has nothing to do with state. That's what I was trying to make clear too, and we understand that. But we want to be able to utilize the same data that the congressional apportionment is going to be using to redistrict.
But we don't have a choice in terms of that, correct? Under the Supreme Court ruling?
No, that's not my understanding of it. That the Supreme Court ruling only speaks to the use of the full enumeration for the congressional seats,
right.
But it doesn't. Since it doesn't speak to the other side, that's still up in the air.
Okay.
And this is urging Congress and the President and the Census Bureau to allow states to utilize the same data, not forcing states to use the statistical sampling method.
Okay, Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes.
The 1990 census shows us with about a 2% undervote, and if we use that type of data and continue to show an undervote undercount of about 2%, would you agree with me that that would reduce the amount of income sent to Oregon on a per population basis from the federal government for roads, health care, child care, et cetera?
I understand that the data that the census collects is how we get a lot of this federal money. I understand that. I think the point of this is, and unfortunately I don't know enough about it to speak to that, I'm sorry, but it's trying to solve the problem by actually addressing the problem head on. If you're having problems counting these people in these 11 targeted problematic cities, address it head on, hire people in those areas that are familiar with the areas, and get them to actually count real people. And then also don't subtract real people that have been counted out and add phantom people. Let's just address the problem head on and try to count real individuals.
So the purpose is to avoid litigation when we do redistricting in 2001. Is that the purpose of doing this?
I think, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, turn around. My purpose is that you actually do account and that you do approach it head on and that you do hire individuals who can go in and count those who have been in undercount category. And to encourage Congress in Washington and the President to do so.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, does something like this have to be limited to one end? Can it be dual? I mean, would like the fact to avoid litigation at the state level, but also to try to increase fairness by having individuals actually counted instead of a formula created by a statistician deleting people some places and adding phantom people other places.
Okay. I'm just basing it on a congressional zone. Congress's study that said it was more accurate to use statistical sampling and that we get better results at less cost through a statistical sample. It's just Congress. I guess my concern is, and my point is, I understand that addressing individual congressional districts, but and how we draw those on a federal level, but that really does not necessarily have to do with how we apportion legislative districts in the state of Oregon, correct? You don't agree with me?
Well, I don't disagree with you that's what it speaks to, but I think that we're simply asking to be able to use the same data that's done for that. If it's good enough data for the apportionment of congressional seats, why are we not able to use a full enumeration for the redistricting of our own legislative seats?
Mr. Chair, I guess my concerns are time frames. I mean, we provide a provision for a post-census local review. The U.S. data, my understanding, is available in April 2001. We're required to adopt the plan by July 31st. How do we review the data? I mean, who decides? I just think there's a whole bunch of logistical questions that I'd like to have answered. And I appreciate the fact that you're just the messenger, but it'd be good to have someone who could answer the questions.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I think also this is just urging Congress and the President to take a certain direction, and I don't think, from my understanding, that it won't be done on a state-by-state basis. I think it will be a decision that would be made for the country.
And my concern, Mr. Chair, is one, I have some questions that I want to have answered, but two, that I don't think the resolution accurately reflects the Supreme Court case, at least my reading of it, and that there's some time frame concerns that I have and some implications that I have in terms of, you know, what does this do for us in terms of a long-term basis. So, anyway, I'll leave it at that.
Senator Miller. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm not aware of the congressional study that Senator Brown was referring to, but it's, I think, my recollection that the members of Congress right now the majority do not want this statistical sampling method to be used, and instead would want the enumeration that you all are urging. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I can't speak for the House, but now they will receive the full. That's what the Clinton, President of the United States, v. Glavin, January 25th, speaks to. They will get the full enumeration for sure. That's what the Supreme Court decision was. So they will. It was saying that because it's a constitutional question that says they have to be reapportioned using a full enumeration. So that's why it only spoke to that, and it didn't speak to using the data for anything else necessarily. But that it was good enough for them, I suppose.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's in fact the case. We don't have a choice in terms of apportionment for congressional districts. I'm just saying we may not necessarily want to use that same data in terms of how much federal dollars come to the state of Oregon and how we do our legislative districts. So we don't have a choice on the congressional district apportionment.
Thank you very much. Anyone else desire to testify on HKM 8?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. That will close the public hearing on SJM 8. Open a work session on SJM 8.
SJM 8? I move House to Memorial 8 to the floor with a pass recommendation.
Senator Miller has moved SJM 8 to the floor.
I guess I'm sorry that we adopted the amendment and it got ahead of myself.
Oh, that's right. There was an amendment.
Yes, there was. It would be dash twos, and I would move that we adopt dash two amendments to House Joint Memorial 8.
Any objections? Not so ordered.
I would move amended bill House Joint Memorial 8 as amended to the floor as you pass recommendation.
Senator Miller has moved HJM 8 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I'm a no vote. This resolution does not accurately reflect the Supreme Court case. I have a lot of questions that that I can't get answered.
I'll withdraw my motion.
I'm a no.
We've had the withdrawal of the motion. We will close the first session on JM 8. HJM 8. Yeah. And we're going to move forward to SJR 23. We'll open a public hearing on SJR 23. We have
you have me.
We have you.
We have some others too, but Mr. Chairman, I thank you for this hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 23. It's a very simple, yet I think laudable change regarding term limits right now for those who serve in the Oregon House of Representatives and the Oregon State Senate. As you know, in 1992, voters in this state passed the only version of term limits they had before them, and that was to prescribe that a person could only serve 12 years in their lifetime in this assembly, and further, that you could only serve 3 terms in the Oregon House and 2 terms in the Oregon Senate. In 1991 of that year, I happened to have been an author of a bill that would have reflected what Senate Joint Resolution now proposes, and that is that a 12-year lifetime limit be imposed. Actually, mine didn't have the lifetime limit, 12-year limit. But it would be of little regard as to where the individual served those 12 years. It would be a matter for that individual, as importantly as for the electorate who chose to send that person to Salem or chose to keep them at home. In any event, Senate Joint Resolution 23 seeks to change just the limits respecting the places where you may serve for 12 years and drops the limitations on the 3 terms in the House, 2 terms in the Senate, and simply provides that you may serve 12 total years in a lifetime, and then we will thank you very much and wish you well. That is all it does. It calls for an election at the next regular general election. I'm not sure it would have any impact. I don't know how we would achieve it to have an impact on those who are currently serving. I guess they can come back, perhaps, in certain circumstances if voters approve this. But it is also my view, again, and I'm sure that those who are supportive of the current term limit version, at least a number of them, are not all that excited about this change. But I also believe that had voters been given this option in 1992, this could have been equally attractive, if not more so. I don't believe that it is really a violation of what the voters adopted with respect to limiting terms. It is just a little bit more sensible. And as a participant, I think you would realize that our service in this building is relatively similar, whether it be in the House or whether it be in the Senate. And I think we will understand as time goes by that, for instance, being able to elect officers of some experience in each chamber to be the chief officers might be to our advantage.
I appreciate that, and Representative Randall Edwards has joined us. No,
that's that Beck.
Oh, that's a Beck.
Yeah, he stays, and we don't recognize him.
No, I just said that.
Want to ask by?
No, just here to listen. Okay, well, what we
Representative Edwards was a co-sponsor of this bill,
and he was listed as a potential witness, but he's not here. Kathy Eden?
Senator Starr, Senator Miller, since you seem to be the two of the committee that are here, for the record, I'm Shappy Eaton, Government Chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We appreciate this opportunity to express our support for SJR 23. The League is on record as opposing term limits themselves. We believe that elections provide term limits. However, since we have them, we feel that in the interest of consistency and effectiveness, a full 12 years allowable to members of the House so they could serve six terms, if so, would provide exactly the kind of leadership and continuity and institutional memory that we are fast losing under our current system. When people in the House are here for three terms and then they're gone, they've just really gotten into knowing how to operate, and that leaves the leadership to newer people who don't have that experience. So we are in support of 23, and we hope that the committee will look upon it favorably and refer it to the people.
Thank you for your question.
Thank you for your support.
Appreciate that. Anyone else care to testify on SJR 23? Yes.
I'm David Buchanan, the Executive Director for Oregon Common Cause. I just wanted to briefly add our support to this bill. Like the League, we also have opposed term limits as a concept, but this is an improvement on the current term limits restrictions that we have. I wanted to add that there's a rationale for offering this back to the voters again. In the time between when it was originally adopted and when it would be presented to the voters again, some additional information will be available to the voters, and that is they will have had a chance to see the actual consequences of this law. And I think that a number of people have seen consequences that they don't agree with and are willing to change their mind, particularly the before this, the adoption of this law, we did have term limits applying to the governor and the statewide constitutional officers. And so one line of thinking was, well, if it's good enough for them, let's put it on the legislative office holders as well. I think what has happened is that people have become aware that there is a substantial difference in the jobs of an executive where term limits can make some rational sense to prevent a single office holder, a single power holder from being able to exercise power for an unlimited length of time with no term limits versus the concept of a legislator. A legislator has no individual power greater than the other members of the legislative body. Their power is through cumulative action. And that cumulative action is a victim of this term limits law. It has made cumulative action by members of legislative bodies more difficult. And I think that that's a consequence that nobody in talking about this law and its anticipation foresaw, that it would be consequently more difficult for legislative bodies to perform their legislative function, which involves cohesion and compromise and finding agreement among multiple office holders, so that if those office holders are additionally limited in the length of time that they have to learn their job and execute their job, then that's a restriction that I don't think any of the voters or advocates for term limits had taken into account. I think that now the voters see that there is an additional negative factor that term limits have brought, so that by making it more flexible, making it a little bit, giving more leeway for the voters to have the ultimate say on who should be their legislators, I think this law would be a tremendous improvement, and I think there are substantial reasons why voters would be able to have a different base of information for making their decision if this is put out to the voters again a second time. And I thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
One thing I appreciate Mr. Buchanan's testimony is the limits that are currently embodied, I think, are a bit misleading. And when you describe to somebody 6 years in the Oregon House, is really the equivalent of about 20 months
in session time.
Session. And I think if a lot of voters, and hopefully they'll get the opportunity to learn this, might conclude that is not too much. And really, even I was figuring a 12-year term is about 3 years of actual in this building service.
And that's an additional factor that during the campaign proposing term limits, ideas like that, concepts like that, were really not part of the campaign. My recollection of the campaign was more or less just a come down hard on the bad guys, the politicians, but I think that the voters have a better sense of what their public servants do for them, and I think that the opportunity to reassess this issue, as you said in your earlier testimony, had this question been before the voters, I agree that I think the voters would have opted for this with its modified version of term limits rather than the one that was the only choice before them.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone else care to testify on SJR 23? Not to close public hearing. And we'll open a work session for the purpose of committee discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Before I move this, I want to in advance thank Senator Brown for the courtesy that is about to take place. But also point out that the term limits that began to run in 1992 continue, so that this is not something to bail out some who might be getting close to the edge and somehow they will have their contract extended by virtue of passing this particular measure. If in terms of the total 12 years of service, that clock began ticking in 1992 and will continue uninterrupted. So I think that's an important point. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Resolution 23, well, perhaps you won't be courteous now. Senate Joint Resolution 23 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll see if we need
to. Senator Miller has moved. SJR 23. Moved.
Oh,
to the floor with a due pass. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
since the real vote arrived, and I don't need to be a courtesy, I just want to explain, I'm not opposed to this, but I haven't seen any polling to suggest that Oregon voters are supportive of making this change at this point, and I think politically it doesn't make sense to do it now, that we're better off to wait 4 to 6 years until term limits have really had an impact on the legislature. I certainly agree that they've had an impact in the House. I just think they hit the tip of the iceberg on the Senate side, and just voters haven't had a sense of that yet. So I think it's too soon. It goes out. It fails. We won't be able to make any changes for a very long time. So that's my reason for my no vote.
You think they'll change their mind after they lose me?
Hoping they no further discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator Brown.
No.
Senator Miller.
Aye.
Senator Stark.
Aye. Senator Steve, the necessary votes. Yes. JR 23 has moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Senator Miller will carry.
Thank you.
We will close the work session on that with JR 23 and open the public hearing. I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1315. Is there anyone that would like to testify on that? We have no one signed up. Ask the committee administrator to tell us what that bill is about.
Senate Bill 1315 would repeal, if passed into law or if signed into law, House Bill 2274, which we previously passed out of this committee. The reason for this is that House Bill 2274 prescribed the regular effective date for legislative acts as January 1 of the year after passage, but it did not apply that to bills, laws passed in this session. Senate Bill 1315 applies the January 1st effective date to laws passed in this session and in subsequent sessions.
Any discussion?
Are we going to work
session? I'm going to close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 1315.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Bill 1315 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Miller has moved Senate Bill 1315 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bowman.
Aye.
Senator Brown.
Aye.
Senator Miller.
Aye.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, Senate Bill 1315 moves the floor with a due pass recommendation. Have the carrier?
Yes.
Senator Miller will carry.
Write that out.
We will open a public hearing on SJR 35 and Secretary of State Phil Kiesling and Senator Brown.
I'll go sit next to him.
You go supporting the honor. Great.
Members of the Chair Starr, members of the committee, did you have a copy of the bill?
I do, actually.
As you know, I've come before this committee several times talking about the issue of over-amending of the Oregon Constitution. One of the reasons I believe that the Constitution in Oregon is over-amended is the concern that people express that, gee, if a statute is passed, the legislature can simply change it. And not only can they change it, which I actually think the legislature has the right to do and should exercise, obviously, with appropriate discretion. They can change it in such a way that they can put an emergency clause on it and then prohibit the referendum power from even taking effect. So, for example, Measure 9, a campaign finance reform measure that was that's overturned by the Supreme Court, was not much lamented by members of this body of both parties, I know, but was something that passed through the ballot and was passed as a statute. And there was an effort in the Senate in 1995 that would have, in effect, repealed it and declared an emergency, thereby preventing people from even using the 90 days they have under the Oregon Constitution to collect signatures and force a vote on it. Doesn't happen very often, but it's happened several times. The most recent example was the light rail appropriation bill that people collected signatures on, and their appropriation bills cannot have an emergency clause on it. And that was an example of a referendum. SBR 35 would address that by saying quite simply that a statutory change, if the legislature does want to make a change or repeal it outright, that it cannot put an emergency clause on it. I suggest that the committee might look at perhaps limiting that a bit if they want to proceed on this. For example, is there a period of time you want to impose that requirement on it, and maybe after a certain period of time you may not. There may indeed be, and I'm sure people will tell you that, you know, there may be bona fide emergencies and you wish you might want to have another out, and maybe there's some ways to do that. And I also would suggest that if you look favorably on this, that you might look at incorporating it into some other changes in the initiative process as well. As you know, I've spoken directly to the moving to a 5% for statutes and 12% for constitutional amendments. I think this actually could be paired reasonably with something like that to tell the voters that we understand their concern about the emergency clause potential. I don't think it's ever happened, but their potential is out there, and is one of the reasons people give is going to statute, but also trying to do some other things as well for the larger goal, which is to try to reverse this process of over-amending the Constitution, which is so clear. So with that, I'll let Senator Brown speak to this.
Did you have a question, Mr. Chair?
Please. We just passed a bill to the floor that would establish that measures passed this session would become effective January 1st instead of 90 days.
Right.
How would that, in your opinion, affect what we're trying to do with this bill?
Mr. Chair, I think the 90 days quite, I think that's something to look at. Not an attorney, but I think the clear purpose of this is to connect it to the emergency clause issue.
That's in the Constitution.
That's in the Constitution, and there may be a way to I just simply specify it that way. That's the clear intent.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Senator Kate Brown with Senate District 7. Thank you for giving this Senate Joint Resolution a hearing. In response to your question about the 90 days versus the first of the year, that bill was introduced by a lawyer, Mr. Phil Claudi, out of Lake Oswego, who was concerned that lawyers would not have access to and basically have a hard time accessing the new ORS volumes at the time the laws actually go into effect, and there's some lag time before they actually get the volume, so they're practicing law under the new statutes, which they sometimes have difficult accessing. So in response to your question, I'd like to make them consistent. However we would go, it would make sense to make them consistent. Colleagues, when I came to the Capitol this session, I had one primary goal, and that was to restore voters' confidence in their government, and I see that SJR 35 is a small step in that direction. It recognizes two things. Voters in Oregon value our initiative system highly, and their will, as expressed by their votes, deserves to be respected by the legislature. And secondly, sometimes those voters pass laws that need technical fixes, as we did last night with the Death with Dignity law. And sometimes those laws, for the good of all Oregon, need to be repealed. But we should do that in such a way that the citizens who pass those laws can participate and feel that their decision has been respected. SJR 35 simply says that any amendments or complete repeal of a voter-approved law cannot take effect until 90 days after the end of the session, allowing voters an opportunity to review those changes and file a referendum if they determine it to be necessary. It applies to all initiatives for 6 years after they're passed by voters, allowing ample time for the legislative review and protecting the interests and will of the voters. And as it amends the Constitution, SJR will certainly give voters the opportunity to prove it on the November 2000 ballot. This idea was not my brainchild. My recollection is that it came from folks that testified on the initiative process of several hearings that this committee had at the outset. And I believe it was Lloyd Marbet, but I don't recall that for certain. But I did get a letter, and it was asked that it be read, dated 4/22/99, Dear Senator Starr, as previously, I do request that the following position on SJR 35 is read aloud into the record by either one of the committee members or a member of the staff. SJR 35 is opposed by a coalition for initiative rights, and rightly so. The will of the people is not subordinate to that of the legislature, nor should it be. This amendment seeks to defeat the purpose of Oregon's initiative process through manipulations and delays. We ask that you reject SJR 35. Respectfully, Ruth Bendel, and she gives her phone number. So,
I'm back to the question. I feel that that there's a misunderstanding of what we're trying to do with this bill in this letter's response. It seems to me that what we're trying to do with this bill is provide certitude for the opportunity of the people to say, no, that's not where we want to go, and so they would have the opportunity for the be involved in the process instead of, at the present time, they don't have that certitude at all because we could put an emergency clause on the bill.
Yes.
Is that your clear understanding of what we're trying to do here?
Senator Starr, yes. I will note, and I've actually spoken to members of the coalition about this very issue, and I thought they had a good point about the emergency clause issue. They, however, have proposed other ways to deal with the perceived problem of legislative meddling and initiative measures. There was a measure on the ballot in 1996 that said that no statute passed by initiative can be changed at all unless it's put out for another vote in the first 5 years, and then after 5 years, it could then only be changed by a supermajority, which I think was along the lines of 4/5 of either House. That, I think, goes too far in the other direction. That's that, in effect, I think, takes away from the legislature the ability, if there is clear agreement, a problem, and the like. Even the proponents may want to change the bill, but in that case, if you're prevented to without holding another election, you have cost issues, et cetera. So I think that's the wrong solution to this potential problem, and this is a much better one, and I think it actually addresses a concern, but I won't try to speak to members of the coalition.
Thank you. Further questions?
I was just thinking that if there's any impact here with measures 50 and 47 and whether or not it would interfere with our ability to make changes advocated by the sponsors.
Mr. Chair?
Act passed by the Assembly.
Mr.
Any portion of the law.
Mr. Chair, I think the first decision of Senator Miller on that would be, of course, 47-50 were constitutional amendments, and the legislature can do nothing to change a constitutional amendment. It can only make a referral of changes in that. And that may be a distinction that may, I don't know if the bill draws it as clearly as it needs to be, but I see the intent of this as even with statutes that are passed via the initiative.
If I can further inquire, another example on the one we dealt with last night. It seems to me in the 1997 session, there was a proposal to make some amendments, and that it didn't pass, but would we be hindered from making those kinds of changes that, again, sponsors advocated as an immediate improvement of something they passed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, under this, you would still be able to make the changes. You just couldn't put an emergency clause on them to prohibit the referendum. Under the example the Secretary of State cited, that the approach the coalition wants to use, I think it would make it very difficult for us to make the changes we did make in the death within the sea law. Did that answer your question? You still look
puzzled. This may be a nice solution when searching for the problem. What is it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, it's a very narrow problem, and that is on when we make changes or repeal voter-approved statutes, essentially. If we put an emergency clause on it, it does not allow the people to do a referendum. It's a very narrow problem.
Explain for the record the referendum process.
Yes, under Oregon's Constitution, the little-known cousin of the initiative, the referendum, which voters would have 90 days to collect signatures equal to 4% of the votes cast in the governor, the lower threshold, but a much quicker time. You have to do it within 90 days. And speaking to Senator Miller's concern, I think you've identified the one best argument against something like this, which is you could create a scenario under which even the proponents say this change needs to be made in its emergency, we should make it right away, and this would take that away from it. And there are other things I know you're considering, for example, making the effective dates of initiatives passed. I believe Senator Bryant had a bill like that, that at least the session would meet in between. You might be able to identify it then before the effective date for that, but there's always that possibility. I think the trade-off is, in terms of a problem, not just what Senator Brown said, but quite honestly, the desire to avoid much worse ways to address this kind of concern. And the bill that would have tied the legislature's hands quite a bit in terms of making any changes almost passed in 1996. I wouldn't be surprised to see something like that surface again. I think that would be a bad way to do it because, in my view, the initiative and the legislature are basically co-equal branches of the legislating power in Oregon, and we can debate the people on either side say which is superior and which is inferior. I mean, most Oregonians see the two as two sides of the same coin, want to see some interaction between the two, but want the rules of that interaction be seen as fair. And I think there's a general unfairness issue where you have the possibility that the people could pass something and the legislature could repeal it outright, put an emergency clause on it, and in effect say to the people who passed it, the only recourse you have is either to recall us or to go out and circulate another initiative petition to reinstate the law that we just repealed. Now, those are possibilities, and some people may say they're better. I don't. I think this is just a reasonable way to make those rules of engagement, in effect, more balanced.
Further questions?
Sure. In my 6 years, the only time I heard the objection seriously raised was when we did the light rail and put the emergency clause on, because I can remember the opponent said you're not giving us the time to go out and refer the matter. And frankly, until that happened, I didn't realize that the referral had to be within 90 days of passage or the end of session.
Senator Bryant, Mayor, it's end of session.
End of session. So, but I've heard that argument raised a couple times, and I'm trying to think of a scenario where something would pass and you have to, with the sponsor consent, say we need to change this because it's just not working and it's in law, and so we'd have to live with 90 days after the end of session, with whatever that situation is.
And Senator Bryan, you do pay a price in sense of delay. I imagine the scenario in which the proponents agreed that the change was necessary is one that would make it very unlikely that there would be any active effort to refer it, get a referendum on it. But you'd have to wait to talk.
Thank you very much. We've got one additional
Andrea? Maya? Oh, you're gonna do a handoff here. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't sure I'd be able to be here. Testify and had asked my legislative director, Andrea Meyer, to sign up to testify. For the record, I'm David Sedanke, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. Our concern about this proposal is the one that Senator Miller identified and that you've been discussing, which is the situation where an initiative statute has been approved and everyone who has been active on the issue agrees that improvements to the statute need to be made and ought to be put into effect as soon as possible. We are actually in the middle, I believe, in this legislative session of making that type of change to the Medical Marijuana Act, which was approved by voters last fall. Since the passage of Measure 67, the proponents of the measure have been meeting actively with representatives of the law enforcement community, and we have reached consensus on changes to that act that we believe will make it more workable both for law enforcement and for patients with debilitating medical conditions. And that bill is scheduled for a work session Thursday morning in the House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law. And I expect there will be discussion at that work session about adding an emergency clause to the bill. In general, we agree that this proposal is preferable to the much more draconian initiative constitutional amendment that was rejected by voters a few years ago that would have completely tilted the scales of legislative power towards the initiative process and taken away significant power from the legislative assembly. We believe that that proposed amendment was defective, that it would have been thrown out by the courts as violating the federal constitution, if not the Oregon constitution, that it was a major change to the Oregon legislative power. And if the committee wants to move forward with this proposal, we would strongly encourage you to add language to subsection 2, providing an exception for the circumstance where the chief petitioners of an initiative measure support the changes being made by the legislature. In general, we think the system as it is now has worked well, that there are enough checks and balances in the system. A governor can veto an emergency clause without vetoing the underlying legislation. And the legislature has generally been pretty cautious about changing measures that have been approved by the voters. Measure 51, which sought to repeal ballot measure 16, could have been approved by the legislature as a statute and subjected to a referendum. However, the legislature chose to put it on the ballot and go the extra mile. It was defeated, of course, by the voters by a wide margin. But even in that situation where the legislature in its judgment strongly disagreed with the policy judgments that have been made by the voters, it had the respect for the voters to put that issue back before the voters. I think the legislature that goes ahead and repeals a measure or makes changes that are objected to by the proponents of an initiative really takes its political future, puts its political future at risk. And I think the legislature has been pretty cautious in doing that. Nevertheless, I do agree with the statements that were made by the Secretary of State that there are much worse proposals out there to erode the authority of the legislature to make necessary changes to laws that have been approved by the people. And, you know, we would not object to this if there were a provision in it that made an exception for that circumstance where the chief petitioners agreed that the changes need to be made.
Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Anyone else care to testify? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing, open work session, discuss what was on with this measure.
Mr. Chair, I think the exception idea is a good idea. It's a good safety valve in the event there is an emergency, a mistake, and the chief petitioner has agreed to it. I think that should be an amendment we should have drafted and add to the resolution.
Well, Mr. Chairman, like Mr. Fidanke said, I'm not sure that the legislature has abused the will of the public, and it's a judgment situation, and I'd be less flexible. I also would be a little bit nervous about putting that much authority in the hands of a chief petitioner, presumably speaking on behalf of 500,000 Oregonians who may have voted for something for reasons wholly apart from the views of the chief petitioner. So I think, you know, the legislature hopefully responds to the will of Oregonians. I know there have been times on measures that have been passed where we've been chided for saying, oh gosh, maybe we should ask you that same question one more time. And some members were, you know, that was a topic of conversation at campaign fairs, and rightly so. But I know all of us, I believe most of us, are pretty cautious, as Mr. Fidanke said, about kind of saying, well, you know, we're going to override what they said, or we're going to question that. I think usually, even if we personally disagree, we allow it to work its will for some time, and then maybe if we sense there's an opportunity to change, we come back. I just don't see the problem.
Well, I appreciate the discussion. It's the chair's decision that we will take this under advisement. Look at the recommendation of the Secretary of State as far as potential of joining it to another measure that might move. And with that, we're going to close the work session on SCR 35 and move on to a public hearing on House Bill 2414. We'll invite Mr. Vannetta to come forward.
I am Fred Vannetta, appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon Building Industry Association in support of House Bill 2414. Very quickly, this bill is a paper reduction act, and as you can tell by the loud crowd behind us, it has a great deal of interest. It deals with a political action committee that makes contributions to candidates running for local offices. The way the law is presently written, when you make a contribution to a candidate for a local office, you make an initial filing with the, let's take a city, you make an initial filing with the city clerk, and then you file the pre-election reports and the post-election reports through the election cycle. And then the law requires you to file a supplemental report until the PAC has no money left in it. So the net effect is if we make a contribution to a candidate running for a local office, we have to file, because we don't ever close out a political action committee of the sort that associations operate. We have to continue to file with a local jurisdiction forever. And that law is, now I didn't check when the law was passed. It's been on the books for several years. The home builders are, the Oregon Building Industry Association is filing with a couple dozen jurisdictions now, and every election we add a bunch more. And when you send them, when you no longer have a candidate in the race and you keep sending them the reports, they don't want them, but if they don't take them, we're subject to a fine. The bill was before this body last time in a larger package of election law changes that met a bad end. This time I hitched it to no wagon. It comes standing all by itself. At the last, 2 years ago when it was up, both the elections division of the Secretary of State's office and the County Clerks Association testified in favor of it. They have not shown up this time to express their support for it as a standalone, but it comes to you without criticism. I will stop before I lose any votes.
How'd you do in the House?
As I recall, there were no negative votes on it.
All right, to be here.
I don't have that information.
It passed unanimously out of committee. I will tell you that Pauline Seelock from the Elections Division called me today and said that they do support this.
Chair, I'm convinced.
All right. We're going to close the public hearing and open work session on House Bill 2414.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2414 to the floor to be passed.
Senator Bryant has moved House Bill 2414 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Hearing none. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryant.
Aye.
Senator Miller.
Aye.
Senator
Scott. Aye. Having received the necessary majority, House Bill 2414 moved to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Carrier.
I'll carry.
Senator Bryant will carry. With that, we close the work session on House Bill 2414. We've completed our work for today. Thank you kindly. We adjourn.